was kind of given by the organizers is strengths in particle physics. This is actually a more than 20-year-old subject, so it would be rather unrealistic if I tried to cover every aspect of this very broad field in just two lectures. So I would try to be very selective in the topics that I'm going to discuss. However, I hope that the topics that I have chosen for these lectures would give you a flavor of the subject. And so I'll try to highlight some of the general lessons that we have learned, and also the kind of issues that you would encounter when you try to construct realistic models from string theory. So you will see some explicit examples being discussed, but they are introduced for a specific reason. So this is a rough outline of my lectures. I will begin by motivating why strings in particle physics is an interesting and an important subject to think about, not only because the organizers said so. Then I would introduce to you the basic ingredients of these lectures, namely D-brains and fluxes. I would try to do it rather briefly at first, because we will discuss specific properties later on in much greater detail, and also because there were already a couple of lectures on fluxes last week, although perhaps with a different perspective. So if you wish, this part of the lectures is sort of like a trailer, so you'll get an idea of what you're going to see in the rest of the course. Now, after this broad overview, you guys should be all very excited and motivated to try to learn about how to construct a standard model of string theory. So for the second part of the lectures, I will actually be switching to the blackboard so that I can go over some of the derivations much more slowly. So the topics that I would like to discuss include intersecting brains, magnetized D-brains, and D-brains as singularities. So you will see exactly what that means later on when we actually introduce this concept. And these concepts are introduced for a reason, because they provide different but somewhat related mechanisms to obtain chiral fermions in string theory. And as you know, chiral fermions is a very important property of the standard model. Now, this would probably take up most of the lectures today. And tomorrow, we would combine what we have learned today, as far as D-brain model building is concerned, with fluxes that you have learned last week. And we will discuss attempts to construct somewhat more realistic models, models that have the spectrum of the standard model, or actually more precisely the supersymmetric version of that, and also the possibility to also stabilize moduli. And that's why we combine them with fluxes. And finally, I would like to tell you a bit about what throats or what models in string theory. They are interesting for several reasons, both from the point of view of the hierarchy problem, and also they are heavily used in the construction of string inflection model, a topic that Liam already discussed briefly yesterday. So this is where what we are trying to cover. Now, before I go on, let me stress in the very beginning that as a complete subject, string phenomenology is not only about model building. There are a lot of other interesting and important aspects, for instance, calculating the low energy couplings and the interactions, as well as the string corrections and so on and so forth. And also the studies of phenomenological features. For instance, if you construct a model, then you would like to know what are the things that you might hope to see at the RxC, for instance. Now, in view of time, since we have only two lectures on this topic, we will be focusing only on the model building aspects. But fortunately, if you are interested in the other aspects of the field, you can see discussions about these other aspects that we skip in this review articles. And you will also see a lot of very useful references in that article. And if you just follow the references, you would eventually get an idea of what has been done and what are the interesting things that are left to be done. Now, so in order to not lose sight of the big picture, so let's begin with some motivations. Now, as you have learned from the lectures last week, many scenarios have been proposed for particle physics beyond the standard model. as well as for early universe cosmology. Now, we don't know whether any of these ideas are right, but before we actually confront these ideas with experiments, I think it is important to be able to assess whether some of these ideas are in fact motivated at all. Now, in many of these scenarios, if not all, the physics is actually oftentimes sensitive to physics at very high energies. So one would like to be able to evaluate these ideas or opportunities in a framework that we can trust in the UV. And this is where string theory comes in, because string theory unifies gravity with the gauge interactions. So this provides the arena to address the questions, not only bits and pieces, like only questions about particle physics or only questions about cosmology, but to put all these things together in a complete picture. Now, one of the beyond the standard model ideas that would require a UV completion is the idea of extra dimensions. And if you have been doing your homework and have been paying attention to the lecture last week, the signatures of extra dimensions is very spectacular, but it also depends sensitively on what's the shape of the extra dimensions. The signatures would be very different for scenarios where you have large dimensions or whether the dimensions is warp. Now, it is therefore of phenomenological value to see if any of these ideas can be, or in what way, be realized in string theory. In particular, if you recall, in the case of the warp extra dimensions, the first thing you might want to look for at the RxE would be in the form of some KK resonances. These are copies of KK copies of the gravitons, for instance. But the precise signatures, namely the masses of these KK particles and the couplings, cross-section, and so on and so forth, depends quite sensitively on the shape of these dimensions. So it is important to figure out what kind of warp models can arise from a theory that you can trust in the UV. And this is not only about extra dimensions, and this is also for other scenarios as well. One might hope that string theory, being a theory that we can trust arbitrarily high energies in the UV, may give us some insights on whether certain extensions beyond the standard model can indeed be completed in the UV. Now, an obvious question you would ask at this point is, well, it's true that there are many scenarios beyond the standard model, and in fact, way too many. But there are also many different ways or many different paths that could lead us to the standard model from string theory. So which one should we actually take? And if we are unlucky, we may actually end up completely lost and get nowhere. Now, indeed, the number of possibilities has expanded quite significantly since the second string revolution. Other than compactifying the hadronic string on the Calabi-Yau, as was known since the 80s, perhaps before some of you were born. We now know of many different ways in which we can construct string theory models with non-abelian gauge groups and chiral fermions. These are essentially the basic ingredients of what we would call a realistic model. For example, you can consider compactifying M-theory in the same way as in Carrato-Witten, where the standard model lives on some end of the universe brains. Or you may consider things like M-theory on a G2 manifold, a seven-dimensional manifold, where the gauge and chiral sectors are localized on some singularities on the seven-dimensional spaces. F-theory on Calabi-Yau 4-fold, I believe Frederick briefly introduced that in his lectures. So this is another possibility. Or you may consider D-brain models, backgrounds which have no geometrical interpretation at all, and so on and so forth. And so, like a kid in a candy store, we have a hard time to pick and choose which one should we pick. Now, for the purpose of our lectures, we will be focusing only on D-brain models. And there are several reasons for that. First of all, brains are so essential in many of the new testable scenarios of string theory. And also beyond the standard model physics. So it would be good to have a good understanding of brains from the point of view of string theory and see what are the things that we may expect. Now, another reason why we would be sticking to only D-brain model is because actually all these different limits of string theory are in fact related by duality. So there's actually no real fundamental reason of studying a particular limit, they are all related to one another. So if we are computationally powerful enough, you can start from one of these corners and carry out your computations and recover all the stories that you may have learned from the other limits. But just like the wave particle duality in quantum mechanics, what oftentimes find the physics more transparent in one particular duality frame. And so the reason why we have chosen to look at D-brain models is because the D-brain description is particularly powerful. We know how to describe D-brains, not only as solitons, but we can treat D-brains fully string theoretically as boundary conditions for the open strings. So as a result, D-brain models give you a very strong geometric picture of building a model. And I hope I would convince you at some point during the lectures that D-brain models are really geometric. What you see is what you get. And this is in sharp contrast to some other approach that you might have seen before, in which case you don't really exactly know what you're getting before you fully construct a model. And so another reason why we will be looking at D-brain models is because not only do we look at models with D-brains, we can also combine other tools that you have learned or you will be learning in the course, such as background fluxes, warp throws, or ADS-CFT correspondence. And so you can combine the part of the physics coming from D-brains, namely non-abelian gauge symmetries and chiral fermions, with other nice properties that you might have gotten from these other tools, for instance, stabilizing the moduli, and address questions all together. Now, don't worry about that if you don't know what this slogans mean. You would actually learn exactly what that means, and I will introduce them to you as we go along. Now, first of all, D-brains and fluxes. So just a quick review. We all roughly know what D-brains is. D-brains are solitons on which open strings can end. And they are dynamical objects. They are objects that can fluctuate. And the reason is that the open strings ending on the D-brains describe the fluctuations. So they describe the collective coordinates of the D-brains. The important point for us, as far as building something like a standard model is concerned, is that on the world model of the D-brains, you have open strings. And among all the excitations that you find, it contained always a U1 gauge field. On top of that, there are also a certain number of scalars, which are the Goldstone bosons corresponding to the Brooklyn translational invariants, because the D-brain itself breaks translational symmetries. Now, the Goldstone modes, together with their fermionic partners, the Goldstinos, they are charged under that U1 field. Now, this is only one D-brain, so U1 gauge field is not at all that interesting, at least as far as trying to connect it with the standard model. Now, if you imagine there are several D-brains in your model, then you can consider open strings ending on different set of D-brains. And the W bosons, which corresponds to the open strings ending of the D-brains, has this mass that depends on the length of the strings. So when you put stacks of D-brains on top of one another, the mass of these W bosons becomes masses. And so your symmetry is enhanced. So you no longer have a U1 gauge symmetry, but something like an SU2 if you have two set of D-brains. Now, if you start to put N D-brains on top of one another, you just count the number of independent ways in which you can connect the strings between in which the endpoints can end, you find that there are n squared different ways in which you can construct such open strings. And so the gauge symmetry is enhanced to un. So the existence of this non-abelian gauge symmetries is what makes D-brains an interesting object for model building, because now you can imagine that the standard model would be coming somewhere from a set of brains. So for instance, there could be a set of brains that give you the SU3 color, there could be a set of brains that give you the electro weak gauge group, and so on and so forth. However, this simple picture, as it stands, does not incorporate chiral fermions, which is an important property of the standard model. And a main point of today's lecture is to discuss how one might include chirality in configurations of brains. Now, as Frederick revealed to you, the fact that they are brains also means that they are higher dimensional analog of a gauge field. The reason is that just like an electron coupled to a photon, a D brain coupled to a P form field that lives in the bulk. Now, since we are going to discuss a lot of different types of gauge fields as we go along, it's probably a good place to emphasize that the type of P form fields that we will be discussing are living in the bulk. And these are not the gauge fields that are localized on the brains, like the one that I was drawing earlier. So flux complexifications refers to string theory backgrounds with a non-trivial field strength for these bulk gauge fields. They're called NSNS or Ramon-Ramon fields, depending on where they come from. Now, so of course, to turn on these fluxes, you break some Lorentz symmetry. In order to preserve the four-dimensional Lorentz symmetry, the fluxes that you need to turn on are in the internal space, so not part of the four dimensions. Now, just as what we have understood long time ago from ENM, it costs energy to turn on this background flux. And in the case of string theory compactifications with fluxes, the energy cost in turning on these fluxes depends on the flux quantum. So the fluxes are quantized in order to not get some unphysical phase. And there are a certain number of integers that characterize the type of fluxes that you turn on in the internal space. So the potential, the energy in turning on these fluxes depends on the flux quantum as well as the moduli, which controls the size or the shape of the compact dimensions. So generically, if you write down such a potential, you can minimize them. And you find that the potential is minimized for a specific value of this moduli. And so that's the reason why the moduli are lifted. Now, Frederick probably told you in much more detail how it works in type 2B string theory, which we will be focusing on tomorrow. The energy in turning on these fluxes can be made more precise. In particular, it's known that the three-form flux would generate a superpotential. And so by minimizing this potential energy, you find that the fluxes have to satisfy certain conditions. And this condition is really a condition on the moduli because the fluxes have to be quantized. So the moment when you change the value of this moduli, this condition on the local flux density is no longer satisfied. So I believe Frederick has covered most of the discussion about type 2B flux back here. So I won't repeat what he said, at least not for today, except to remind you that most of the discussion so far have been centered on the pro-string aspects of the back here. Now, in order to incorporate the standard model in this setup, and to make contact with particle physics, we need to introduce open strings in this background. And so part of what we are going to do tomorrow is to discuss some examples where the pro-string moduli are stabilized, whereas there's also an open string factor that gives you essentially the spectrum of the standard model. And as you will see, there are new issues that arise when we try to put all these things together. Now, a point that Frederick probably didn't have time to discuss is that in addition to stabilizing moduli, the background fluxes also have an effect of breaking supersymmetry. In the flux compactification, there are actually different sources of supersymmetry breaking, and the background flux is just one of them. There are effects coming from non-perturbative dynamics, KKLT type of effects, that Liam told me that he covered yesterday. And so among all these effects, one would have to figure out what would be final supersymmetry breaking results on the standard model. But for the moment, let's just pretend that everything is coming from the flux. So how do we see that the background flux could induce supersymmetry breaking effects? And a simple and intuitive way to see why that's the case is to note that the world volume fields, the fields that are localized on the deep brains, describe the position of the brains as well as the dynamics. So the question of whether there will be soft supersymmetry breaking terms induced on the open string sector boils down to the question of whether it costs energies to move the brains around, because the fields that live on the brain describe the dynamics of the brain. So just to be concrete, if you just consider a set of seven brains, for instance, now imagine you turn on some background flux in the presence of the deep brains. The background flux could have an effect of inducing deep brain charge on the world volume of the brains. So some of these fluxes could induce a D3 brain charge. So this system is kind of harmless because the D3 brain charge induced on the D7 brains experience no force in this background. The reason is that if you consider the interactions of this induced D3 charge with the background, there's a gravitational contribution because these brains are gravitational objects. But there's also a force due to the exchange of this Ramon-Ramon field that we introduced earlier. So the net effect combining the gravitational attraction and the repulsion due to this Ramon-Ramon field is exactly cancelled. So this is actually a configuration of brains with fluxes that experience no force. Since there's no force, it doesn't cause energy to move the brains around, and so no supersymmetry breaking terms will be induced. However, not all kinds of fluxes are like that. There could be other fluxes that induce anti-D3 brain charge on the world volume of the brains. In such cases, the gravitational attractions and the repulsion due to this Ramon-Ramon field actually add up. So in those cases, you can show that the D3 brains are not free to move anywhere in this background. They're actually stuck in the place where the flux density is biggest, because that minimizes the energy. And the energy that it caused to move the brains away from this equilibrium position is reflected as a soft supersymmetry breaking terms on some scalar fields on the deep brain world model. So this is the origin of these soft terms.
Now, first,
yeah.
Question.
Yeah.
So how does one go to check this explicitly?
Yeah, so there was a calculation behind, and I don't know actually I will be able to calculate in the second lecture, but you can write down the world one action for deep brains, which includes a Dirac 1 interval term and a transcendent term. And so now you consider turning on this background and see whether the scalars that are living on the brains get a mass or not. This is just to give you an intuitive picture of how things actually work out. Of course, to actually work out the numerical value of the mass, you have to do an actual calculation. So as I said, this is the trailer part of the lecture. After the PowerPoint presentation, when we go to the black hole, we will work out some of these things in more detail. So we'll see how far we can go. So actually, I encourage questions. So if you have anything that you think is confusing, by all means, ask me why I'm lecturing.
So,
yeah.
So these fluxes are different from the ones you wrapped in the internal cycle?
So this is exactly the flux that Frederick was talking about in his lecture. So these are fluxes that
we
have
to close them. Hmm? Need to close them.
So these are quantized. So I'm trying to draw it in a non-compact setting, but you're right. If I want to really be precise, I should compact it by the setup, and the fluxes are supported on the cycles. So, but locally, we cannot really see the difference. So if you only look at the local flux density effect, this is as good as a picture as the actual one. So actually, are there any other questions? Good. Okay. Now, another interesting aspect of fluxes is that it could generate a hierarchy of scale because of the back reaction on the metric. Now, this is part of what I plan to do in the second lecture, namely to consider a setup where the fluxes are localized in the internal space. In those cases, you would see that one could find strongly warped regions within the compact space. And the strongly warped regions is precisely where the fluxes are localized. We will discuss several examples, including the relatively well-studied supergravity solutions known as the Watt-deformed conifer or the Kavanaugh-Schlesser throat. And the reason why I introduce this today is because probably tomorrow when Liam discusses deep brain inflation, he would have to use heavily this kind of Watt solutions. So before you actually see how this Watt backgrounds are constructed, I would like you to see at least intuitively what they are all about. Now, in a lot of these Watt solutions, you find that the space-time is roughly of the form of an ADS5 times an internal space. So this kind of Watt solutions provide a concrete realization of the random spectrum type of scenarios. But however, if you want to ask whether there are some differences, there are some essential differences. Remember in the case of the random syndrome scenario, you would introduce a sharp cutoff in the UV and the IR, because otherwise the Watt factor can become arbitrarily small in the infrared, whereas in the UV at some point the energy scale is above the Planck scale and you don't know what to do with them. So it turns out in this Watt background, you would find, at least in some examples, that the geometry is actually smooth. It actually kept off in the infrared. So not only do you find that the modular, the hierarchy, a large hierarchy can be generated by some moderate choices of fluxes, but the hierarchy is also stabilized. So, and in the second lecture, if we had the chance to actually go through that, we would see that small differences in the Watt geometry can give you significant effects on cosmology and particle physics data. So it's important to understand how to construct these solutions in some detail. Now finally, as Liam discussed in his lecture yesterday, and also he would talk more about it tomorrow, background string theory background with fluxes and Watt throats are heavily used in the construction of string inflation models. So in other words, all these different kinds of motivations all point us to the same questions of how to construct a standard model with deep brains and fluxes. So that's what we plan to do in these lectures. So I will start with something very basic, deep brains and chirality, and try to build up your toolbox slowly, step by step. So this is a list of topics that I really hope to cover. I don't know exactly how much I will be able to cover in two lectures, but I think we would actually be accomplishing something if we go through everything in detail, at least up to this point. So we see how far we go. Now I will switch from the fake blackboard to the real blackboard. And this is probably a good time to stop for a moment and see if you have any questions. So this is the sort of the outline of the lecture. Questions? Maybe the easiest is to just please connect that. Okay. Jama, do you know how to get rid of this?
No.
Thank you. Okay. D-brains and chirality. So as we discussed earlier, D-brains are interesting objects for building particle physics model because the world volume of the D-brains can incorporate non-abelian gauge symmetries. So the interesting point is they're not only solutions to the supergravity equation of motion, but they allow a full string theory description as boundary conditions for the open strings. So I don't know how many of you actually know D-brains inside and out. So if you know D-brains very well, could you please raise your hand? OK, only a few. So you would not, I hope you would not be offended if I tell you something that you already know. But it would be great. OK? So for the purpose of our lectures, there are several properties about D-brains that we need to know. First of all, a D-brain is a BPS object, which means that it preserves half of the supersymmetry. So if you let QL and Q right be the left and the move left and the right moving supercharges of type 2 theory coincidences, the boundary conditions coming from the D-brains kill half of the supersymmetries. So only half of the supersymmetry remains. And in particular, for flat space, a DP brain preserves the linear combination of the supersymmetry Q left plus gamma 0, gamma 1, dot, 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 of the gamma mu, Q right. So only a particular combination survives. And the gammas here are the gamma matrices. And the indices run over the world volume coordinates in the D-brains. A second property that we need regarding D-brains is that a D-brain is a dynamical object. So as we discussed a moment ago, the fluctuations of the D-brains is described by the excitations of the open strings. And the D-brain also coupled to the cross-string degrees of freedom. And the kind of the cross-string degrees of freedom in which the D-brains coupled to include the graviton, so they gravitate, and as well as some Ramon-Ramon field. So depending on the dimension of the D-brains, the type of Ramon-Ramon field in which D-brain couples to are different. Now, if we want to describe the low energy dynamics in D-brains, there are actually several pieces of the action that describe the low energy dynamics. One of them is the Dirac-1-Infeld action, the DBI action. DBI action, my handwriting really is inadequate. Okay, so the DBI action is proportional to the tension of the brain, integrated over the world volume of the D-brains, times determinant of G plus B plus 2 pi alpha times times F. So G here is the induced metric on the world volume of the brains. So you can pull back the metric on the world volume to figure what is G. B is the induced two-form field, and F is the field that actually lives on the brains. So this is the field strength of the gauge fields on the world volume of the brains. So this is just the usual, so F is just the usual field strength of the normal gauge fields. Now, the DBI action already tells us several things that are interesting. So if you forget about the two-form field and the field that the field strength of the gauge fields, the DBI action just reduced to the tension times the world volume of the brains. And this is just a statement that D-brains is a dynamic, is a gravitational object. Okay. All right. So another thing which is interesting is if you expand the DBI action to leading orders in alpha prime, including the gauge field, the field strength, you will find that this gives you the Young-Gill's action for the world volume field. So this gives you something of the form of G Young-Gill square times integration of F square over the world volume of the deep brains. And so that tells you that there is gauge symmetries. Now, when you dimensionally reduce on the world volume of the deep brains, you find that the four-dimensional gauge couplings, 1 over 4D Young Mills, is 1 over G strain times the volume of the thing that the deep brains wrap around. So in particular, to make it dimensionally correct, I have to put in certain powers of the string scale, sorry. So the Young-Mills coupling is inversely proportional to the volume of the cycles that the brains wrap around. And this is not the entire compact space. So in particular, if you calculate the Newton constant, G Newton on the other hand is proportional to the entire volume of the internal space. And this is the reason why for deep brain models, the energy scale, the fundamental energy scale involved, M strain, could be much lower without having direct contradiction with experiments. And so your first homework exercise, although I know that you don't have to turn them in, is to A, fix the numerical constant in all these equations. And that should be very easy because you can find it in, say, Puchinsky's textbooks. The second part of the problem is, suppose that you're considering the standard model on the stack of D3 grain. And supposing that the fundamental scale is actually 1 GeV, how big is the volume of the internal space? How big does the volume have to be? And part C, convince your cousin that this is a good idea. OK, so but this is only part of the deep brain action. This is only the Dirac 1 Intel piece. There's also the West Minow term, which depends on the Raman-Raman field. So another piece of the deep brain action is the West-Minow piece. It's proportional to the charge on the deep brain. Again, you integrate it over the world volume of the deep brain. Where C here is a formal sum of all the possible Raman-Raman forms in your theory. So starting from P plus 1, you can have P minus 1, P minus 3, and so on and so forth. So all the Raman-Raman forms. And this second piece over here is the is a churn character for the gauge bundles on the world volume of the deep brains. So if you just expand it to leading order, it goes like this. And so on and so forth. So there's actually another piece which I have suppressed over here. That could be another piece multiplying the whole thing, which depends on the tangent bundle on the world volume of the deep brains. But they are not very important for our discussion, so I'll just suppress it for now. So this is the Western Inno term of the deep brain action, which tells you how they couple to the Raman-Raman form, as well as the gauge bundle that you can on the world volume. Now the important point for us is the following. So if you just expand this, can you actually see what I write over here? Is that visible? Okay. So the leading term, of course, it just tells us that the deep brain is coupled to the Raman-Raman P plus 1 form. But if you expand to higher order, you will find that there are coupling between some lower dimensional P form, because you can contract some of the indices with the gauge bundle. Right. So I should say that this integral here is implicitly defined such that we will pick out all the P plus one P's in the expansion of the wedge product. So there are many, many terms over here, but the thing that only would be picked up by the integrals are the ones that are P plus one form. So the leading one is the P plus one form that couples to the deep brain. The second one has some contraction with the gauge bundle and so on and so forth. So why do we write down this action for now? The important point that we would need to use later on is the fact that when you turn on the gauge bundle on the world bottom of the deep brain, you will induce lower dimensional deep brain charge. And this point would turn out to be important later when we construct magnetized deep brain models. So the point number three, I guess. So A is EPS, B is the dynamical, and number three, the third properties of the deep brain that we will need to use is that deep brain tend to minimize the volume. Deep brains tend to minimize the volume of the thing that it wraps around. So if you just consider deep brains in that space, the volume minimizing configuration is when the brain is completely flat. So that's the configuration with the minimal volume. However, if you are considering compactifications, the deep brains do not necessarily have to be completely flat. It could wrap around some non-trivial homology cycles within the compact space. So we would come back to this point later. But this is true in general. Okay. Are there any questions so far? Yeah. Good. Now, the deep brain configurations that I was drawing earlier on, unfortunately turned out to be way too simple to incorporate chirality, which is an important property of the standard model. And that's because of the large amount of supersymmetries that is preserved by such configuration. And there's actually an alternative way to see why we don't get chiral fermions. And the reason is as follows. So in four dimensions, chirality is a violation of parity. So you need to find a way to violate parity in the four-dimensional space. But in string theory, when you write down the fermions, 10-dimensional fermions, in terms of its four-dimensional component as well as its six-dimensional component, you note that the chirality in four dimensions is coupled to the chirality in six dimensions. So in order to get chirality in four dimensions, you need to find a way to violate parity in the six-dimensional space. And the kind of deep brains that I was drawing all along is just one deep brain sitting there. It does not pick out a particular preferred orientation in the six-dimensional space. So by just having deep brains sitting in the internal space, what you will find that is that the kind of gauge theory that lives on the brain, they are non-chiral. But this observation also tells us exactly what needs to be done in order to obtain a chiral theory from deep brains. You just have to find deep brain configurations that violate six-dimensional parity. You just have to pick a particular orientation in the six-dimensional space. And there are actually several ways that you can do that. So let's go through them one by one. The first way in which chiral fermions can arise from deep brains is to consider deep brains not sitting in a smooth point of the internal space, but at some singular point. So if you put the deep brain sitting at some singular point in the internal space, you can get chiral fermions. The simplest example of such a singular point is an orbital singularity. And how many of you actually know what is an orbital? Good, so I don't have to, for those who haven't seen that before, an orbital is a discrete identification of space. So the simplest example is to take, say, the complex plane. If you identify points under a 2 pi over 3 rotation, say, so you're identifying points under this discrete symmetries, and the resulting space, the quotient space, is actually singular because you can see that there's a fixed point sitting at the origin. And precisely because of this discrete identification, that gives us an orientation. So if you take the entire six-dimensional space, the simplest example again is if you take a C3 orbital that acts on all the compact coordinates, you find that there are fixed points, and if you put B brains at that fixed point, the discrete identification pick out a preferred orientation. And that gives us chirality. Is that clear? Okay. So, a second way in which chirality can arise is when you turn on a non-trivial gauge bundle of the Verworn gauge field.
Was there a question?
Is that a question?
Why does it give you chirality?
So, of course, you can actually show it in detail when you quantize the string in the presence of an orbital singularity. But an intuitive way, as I said, is to pick out a preferred orientation. Right? So the discrete identification here is a 2 pi over 3 rotation. And so that gives you an orientation. This is in only one of the, this is only in two real dimensions. And if you imagine three copies of that, the direction defined by this rotation give you a preferred orientation in a six-dimensional space. And from the earlier argument, that gives you chirality. So is that clear? So I'm trying to actually say something without doing an actual calculation. I would have been better off if I actually if I actually explicitly show you why that's the case. But that would come next. So another way in which chiral fermions can arise, again, to understand it only intuitively, is to consider D brains, let's say D9 brains, with some non-trivial gauge bundle, some non-trivial magnetic field on the world volume. So if I have D9 brains, I have to wrap the D9 brains around 6 internal directions. And so I can turn on a world volume gauge bundle that looks like this, F wedge, F wedge, F. And this again, pick out a preferred orientation, because that this wedge product defines an orientation as a Bohr bundle. So again, you can show, if you work out, if you quantize open string in this background, you find that by turning on a magnetic field or gauge bundle, you get chiral fermions. Is there a question? Ah, okay. All right.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. You press these efforts in all sorts. What? Many of the is the source.
These are background. So
yes.
Yeah.
So there is no source.
So in particular, I don't know whether so
this is just because the space is compact.
That the space is what?
Compact.
Compact. Yeah. So by Fluxus, I just means that the support of F on the internal space is not zero. So in particular, we'll see examples of that. It's actually very simple configurations. They're constant background. just like what Frederick introduced for the three point seven. So their background. Okay, so the last at least of what we are going to cover, the last way in which chiral premions can arise is when you consider brains that are intersecting. So the third way in which chirality could arise is when you have more than one set of brains and they intersect. So a picture is like this. One D brain and another D brain. The place that they intersect, if the intersection is actually a point, not a surface, then you get four-dimensional chiral premions localized at the intersection. And this is the topic that we are going to cover today. Now, before I go on, I should stress that although I present this three different ways of getting chirality as different methods, they're actually related by simple dualities. So if you wish, you can just stick with one of them. And one way to see this is to consider the following. Start from the magnetized brain. In particular, just to make the problem simple, just look at two dimensions. You turn on the magnetic field on the two torus, for instance. As we said earlier, the presence of this magnetic field induce lower dimensional D brain charge. And so you can think of a DP brain with this magnetic flux as a bound state of a DP brain with some DP minus 2 brain. So we can draw a picture. So the original DP brain wraps around the entire torus. The induced D brain has two lower dimensions, so it's a point in this T2. So a magnetized D brain is a bound state of a DP brain with a DP minus 2 brain. Now I can T2-alize along one direction. What would I find? I find that the first DP brain turns into a DP minus 1 brain. So in particular, if I T2-alize along the vertical direction, the brains that I get is only in the horizontal direction. Whereas if I T2-alize this D brain, I grow the dimensions that are in the vertical direction. So this bound state of DP and DP minus 2 brain turned into a system with two different set of P minus 1 brain, but they are oriented in different directions. So in other words, you can think of this bound state of D brains or magnetized D brains as a single D brains at an angle, because you just sum over these D brains together, and you find that you can think of the magnetized D brain setup as brains at angles. So now you can consider different magnetized D brains with different magnetic charge, and that just translates to the fact that there are now brains that could intersect. And the way in which chirality arises can be understood both ways, either in terms of having a non-trivial gauge field configuration on the world volume of the brains, or in terms of having some particular point in the internal space where the chiral premion can be localized. You would see in more detail in the second lecture that you can also think of deep brains as singularities as equivalent to the other methods. And one way to see it, and a simple way to see it, is to note that the type of D brains as singularities that give us chirality, they are fractional brains. You can think of these fractional brains as some higher dimensional brains that wrap around cycles that are collapsing with some non-trivial gauge bundles of that. So, which means that D brains as singularities can also be related to the magnetized D brain. So I'm not actually saying something new by going from one side of the blackboard to the other. They are all equivalent. So you would now say, okay, why are we introducing these different objects in different stages of the lectures? Why don't we just stick with one of them? And there are several reasons for that. First of all, even though they're equivalent by some duality transformation, sometimes the calculations become much simpler in one duality grain than the other. For instance, if you consider intersecting grains, it's very transparent in the case of toroidal models or orbital examples. But when you try to construct such examples in a general collabial, you have to ask what kind of cycles exist in the collabial, what are the intersections. And generally, the classification of this kind of cycles are not that well understood. You may be better off looking at other picture of getting chirality. And another reason why we would be introducing these three different ways separately is because we will be putting in background three-point flux later on tomorrow. And in the presence of the three-point flux, the duality does not work so simply. Namely, the three-point flux get mapped to some non-trivial metric on the other side of the duality. And so it would be useful to have a well-developed intuition of how to get chirality in each of these pictures separately. Okay, so any questions so far? No. Okay, so for this lecture, we will be focusing on intersecting grains. Intersecting grains. So the basic configuration of intersecting brain models involve at least two stacks of brains. Each of these stacks of D brains a space filling in the four-dimensional space, but they also span an additional three real dimensions. So in some simple cases, you can represent the intersecting brains in some simple picture, and I'll just draw one of such simple pictures. So here is the four-dimensional space, the place where they intersect. Both of them are space filling. But they also span an additional three real dimensions. The fact that they intersect means that the local geometry of the intersecting brain models is specified by the relative angles between the brains. So for the moment, I haven't compactified the theory. So you can think of this as R2, R2, and R2. So all of the dimensions are non-compact for the moment. Okay. So as I said, the current fermions are localized at the intersections. So they live in the four-dimensional space. And the appearance of chirality can be understood from the relative orientation from the brains, namely by rotating one set of brains to the other. That introduced, so if you take one set of D brains, the relative rotation between the set of D brains define a specific orientation, and that's the reason why you obtain chirality. Now, this also explains the type of D brains that we will be considering, D6 brains. So these are D6 brains. So does anyone know why is that the case? Why are we considering D6 brains rather than, say, intersecting D5 brains or D4 brains? Come on.
Because there are six sets.
Because? Yeah, okay. Because they are the only set of brains that would intersect at a point. So imagine if you pick a set of D5 brains or D4 brains, they intersect at a line or a curve. But it's not enough to define a specific orientation in the full six-dimensional space. So to obtain chirality, you need brains that are intersecting at a point in the internal space. And these six brains are the only objects that have this property. So when I draw this picture, I mean really that the D6 brains has three plus one dimensions being a four-dimensional space, and then three additional legs, they are drawn like this, like for simplicity, just to illustrate the point. Now you can quantize the open strain stretch between the two set of brains. So now you can consider it, you can consider open string that stretch between the two set of rings and quantize the strings with these boundary conditions. Yeah.
And this is for QA now, right?
This is for QA, yeah.
You can also build models in
QA. Yeah, so today we are going for only 2A. Tomorrow, hopefully, we'll come to 2B when we consider the magnetized D-brakes. And if we have the chance, we'll talk about more throws too. Okay, so for our purpose, it's enough to just list the result of the spectrum when you quantize the string with these boundary conditions. And if you take, if you look at strings that stretch between the same set of rings, they just give us the usual results, a UN gauge group with three adjoint scalars, as well as the fermion partners. But for open strings that stretch between two set of leaf rings, you get bifundamental fields. So you get fields that are transforming as bifundamental representation of the UN1 plus UN2 gauge group. So say the first set of rings, you have N1 of them, and the other has, you have N2 of such rings. And so the bifundamental fields are charged under this UN plus UN gauge group. Now, you can, of course, be more explicit and write down the boundary condition and so on. So I'll leave it as an exercise for you to do. Okay. So impose the boundary conditions. Namely, it has to be directionally orthogonal to the brains and Neumann along the direction of the brains. And a smart way to do it is just put one set of brains along the x-axis, and you will simplify your life tremendously. And so, when you do the quantization correctly, you would find that the fact that there is one chiral fermion really comes from the following. When you write down the well-shaped fermions in the Ramon sector, so this is for those who want to actually see everything in the most explicit details. If you haven't gone through that calculation yourself, I should encourage you to do that. But you would find when you have gone through this calculation that the fact that there are one chiral fermions localized at the intersection really comes from the fact that in the Ramon sector, there are only two zero modes. So those are the zero modes that are not along the extra dimensions, because those are the ones that are not molded with integer value, because the fact that you have an angle between the D-brains shifts the molding of the well-shaped fermions. It's no longer zero mode, but it's with a shift. There are only two fermionic zero modes in the Ramon sector. And so when you perform a GSO projection, you find that there's only one fermionic degrees of freedom coming from open strings ending on one set of rings to the other. But that's not enough to get one chiral fermion. And the other fermionic degrees of freedom comes from open string going the other way. So that just gives precisely two fermionic degrees of freedom, which give you one chiral wild fermion from the four-dimensional point of view. But this would be your, again, your homework exercise that you will never turn in. All right, so if you believe me, then this is the spectrum of open strings. You engage group with my fundamental fields. I haven't told you about the bosonic states that are localized at the intersections. So this is only the fermionic fields that are bifundamental. In general, there could also be some additional light scalar fields that are localized at the intersections when you quantize open string properly. But the masses of this light open string modes are not necessarily massless, unlike the fermions. And you can show that the mass of this light bosonic state is, could be non-zero, and it takes the following value, theta 1, theta 2, theta 3, so the fourth one is here. So there are, in general, a bunch of scalar fields. They are not massless, depending on the angle between the brains. And for special choices of the angle, you find indeed some massless states, but that's not guaranteed to be the case. They could be massless, they could be massive, or they could be tachyonic, depending on what's the angle. Now, this point will become more clear when we analyze the supersymmetry conditions for the intersecting brain system. And you will see that precisely in the case where the when some of these scalars become massless, that's precisely the system of the brains that preserve a common supersymmetry. Okay, so are there any questions up to this point? Yeah?
If I wanted a third U1, or UN, could I just do another stack of the U-brains?
Oh, yeah, yeah. So far, I have only two UN groups, but if you want an additional gauge factor, you would have to introduce more D-brains. But again, the spectrum is only bifundamental. Right? So if you don't have anything that has more than two indices, that's because you're looking at open strains, there are only two endpoints. So if you have an additional brain, for instance, answer, you would find fields that are bifundamental among two of these gauge factors. But you don't find anything that are charged simultaneously under three gauge groups. At least in the perturbative open strain limit. Are there any questions? Okay, so I was telling you earlier that a deep brain preserved half of the supersymmetry. Depending on the dimensions of the brains. And so the question is, if you have more than one set of D-brains, like here, how do we know that they would not break further supersymmetry? So what's the condition under which you have an unbroken supersymmetric D-brain configuration? So let's say you have one set of brains that preserve this linear combination of the supercharge, and you have another set of brains which could preserve a different set of supersymmetries. So the part which is part of the four dimension is the same, but in the directions, but in the internal direction, the set of supersymmetry preserved by the two set of brains may not be the same. So what that really means is, as far as four dimension is concerned, this gamma matrices run over the same set of indices, but along the internal directions, different set of brains pick out different additional three dimensions. So the set of supersymmetry preserved by the first set of D6 brains and the second set of D6 brains are not identical. Now you can be more precise and see under what conditions they preserve the same supersymmetry. So if you define R as the rotation, that rotate the first set of D brains to the second set of D brains, acting on the spinner representation, then so in order for the two set of brains to preserve the same supersymmetry, you can show that it can only be the case if this rotation R is a subgroup of SU3. So not an arbitrary SU6 rotation would preserve the supersymmetry. This has to be a proper subgroup of SU3. And a simple way to see it is to note that when you have a spinner, so you have to preserve a common spinner, for both sets of brains. So in order for such a spinner to exist, namely a spinner which is invariant under such rotation, the spinner itself transforms as a four representation of SO6, And this four representations decomposed as 3 plus 1 under the SU3 group. And the one here is a singlet, which is invariant under the rotation. So, and the SU3 group is the largest subgroup of SU6 that has this property. So, just to summarize, for two set of deep rings to preserve the same supersymmetry, you should find a rotation that takes you from one set of deep rings to the other, with the rotation being a subgroup of SU3. Is that clear? So, in other words, the angle between the rings have to sum over to 0. So theta 1 plus theta 2 plus theta 3 is equal to 0 mod 2 pi. So for such configuration of deep rings, you have a common supersymmetry. Now, you can show that for such value of the angle, you can go back to the set of scalar field and compute the mass. You will find that there are some massless scalar fields that are localized at the intersections. So they are completing the supermultiplets together with the fermions. And now, generically, when they intersect, you don't have any supersymmetry. You have at least n equals to 1 supersymmetry when the sum of the angle is 0. But you could have more than n equals to 1 supersymmetry. So n equals to 2 or n equals to 4 supersymmetry corresponds to cases where some of these angles accidentally become 0. So for instance, if you set theta 3 equals to 0, you have a configuration of rings that only intersects along the two of them, along these two directions. And so you can show that if, in addition, theta 1 plus theta 2 equals to 0, you preserve n equals to 2 supersymmetries. And n equals to 4 supersymmetry corresponds to only the case when they are completely parallel. So are there questions?
About the rotations.
Yeah.
All the rotations that preserve some supersymmetry have to be in the subgroup SU4 of the SU6.
SU3.
SU3.
Yeah. Yeah, it has to be a subgroup of it has to be a SU3 subgroup of SU6. If you just take an arbitrary SU6 rotation, it doesn't preserve the common supersymmetry. And the reason being that if you decompose the rotation under the spinor representation under the SU3 group, you find that there is indeed a singlet. And that tells you that there is an invariant spinor under the rotation. And that invariant spinor tells you that you have some preserved supersymmetry. Okay. So far I have been only talking about non-compact cases and also toroidal, it also straightforwardly applied to the toroidal cases. But in general, when you try to construct, say, intersecting brain models in a collabial space, you would like to ask what kind of brains would preserve common supersymmetry as well in a general setting. So in general, for a collabial space, the three-dimensional cycles that the D6 brains can wrap around while preserving supersymmetry. It's called a special Lagrangian cycle, special Lagrangian three cycles. And you can see why that's the case, how that come about, by noting that deep brains carry both Ramon-Ramon charge and tension. And so the Ramon-Ramon charge, of course, depends only on the topology. But you can still have deep brains that don't have the tension that exactly saturate the BTS bond. So that's an additional constraint that you need to impose in order for the deep brains to preserve supersymmetry. And so a technical term for such three-dimensional cycles that preserve supersymmetry is called special Lagrangian. And you can define it as follows. So in general, if you have a collabial, you have a holomorphic free form. And you also have a Kähler form. And locally, you can just write down the holomorphic forms in terms of the local coordinates. So a holomorphic free form looks like this. And the Kähler form looks like this. So the requirement for the three cycles to preserve supersymmetry is for it to be special Lagrangian. It is a Lagrangian three cycle if the restriction of the K-dot form on the three cycle is equal to zero. But that doesn't guarantee that the cycle is volume minimizing. So to preserve supersymmetry, you also have to require that it minimize the volume of the cycle, which can be expressed as a property that when you take the imaginary part of this automorphic free form, restricted again on the free cycle, it vanishes. Actually, one can introduce also a phase in defining this special Lagrangian cycle. But the particular phase over here is just a constant. It depends only on the homology class. And so it basically tells you what supersymmetry is preserved by the three dimensional cycles. And so now you can have two different set of brains that preserve different supersymmetry. They can each be volume minimizing, which means that they could have a different value of this phase. But in order for the entire model to preserve the same supersymmetry, they have to be so-called calibrated with respect to the same free cycle, which means that in a globally supersymmetric model, when all these different brains wrapping around all kinds of free cycles are there, in order for them to preserve a common supersymmetry, this phase has to be the same for each of them. And so that imposes some conditions on what kind of brains you can introduce in the setup. Now, for the case where it is actually volume minimizing, you can show that the volume of the three-dimensional cycle is proportional, it's actually equal to the real part of this quantity over here, integrated over the cycle, taking the absolute value sign. So the difference between a D brains and an anti-D brain is just this phase. So if you shift this phase by pi, the volume is still the same. So a brain and anti-brains are both volume minimizing in their own way, but they don't preserve the same supersymmetry. Okay, so again, as a homework exercise, you can show that this formal expression that I wrote down here, namely the cycle that the D6 frame wraps around being special Lagrangian, meaning that it is Lagrangian, and they also satisfy this imaginary condition, just boils down to the simple equation that I wrote down over here for a toroidal example. And in fact, you can show that this condition is automatically satisfied for the kind of D6 frames that I was looking at over here. It's a very simple exercise. Now you can come back and look at the result that we had earlier, namely you have a bunch of scalar fields that could have localized at intersections that could be masters, massive, or tachyonic, depending on the angle. So indeed, the case where you find master scalar fields are the ones that have a commonly preserved supersymmetry between two set of brains. For the case where you find a tachyonic scalar mass, you can also understand why that's the case. As I said earlier, so you have two set of brains. Depending on the angle between them, you could have massless, massive, or tachyonic scalars localized at the intersection. So the massless case corresponds to having a moduli. So this is some open strains stretching between the two set of brains, and there are some bosonic fields that are exactly masters. So what does that mean? That means that you can give a vacuum excitation value of the field without causing any energy. And physically, what happens is when you give a vacuum excitation value to this open strain mode stretched between the brains, you are fusing the brains together because the VEF basically parameterized moduli, allowing you to combine the brain into a single one, as long as the charge carried by the D-brains is conserved. So as long as the D-brain charge carried by the setup is exactly equal to the final one, you can draw a picture showing that the initial configuration with the vacuum excitation value equals to zero is the configuration where you have two D-brains sharply cross each other. As you give the vacuum excitation value to this field, you have a smooth D-brain combining the two cell brains in one. And so we understand that the massless case is just giving us a set of moduli, parameterizing the possibility of fusing the brains into a single one, or so-called D-brain recombinations. The tachyonic case essentially is the same story, except that this process from going from two intersecting brains to a single fused D-brain is triggered dynamically. It's not a flat direction, but this D-brain configuration is unstable, so it tends to pick up a bed. And in the process of picking it up, you get the final recombined D-brains. The last case where the scalars that are localized at the intersection is massive is also quite interesting. So it tells us that there are some configurations of D-brains that are not supersymmetric. Together they break supersymmetry. But you don't find any instability trying to make the brains oriented in somewhat different ways. You only get massive modes. What that means is the D-brain configuration is actually stable against this recombination. So it doesn't like to go from this to a fused D-brain configuration. And so in those cases, you can show that the volume of the recombined cycles of the brains is actually bigger than the volume of the original one. So that's why it doesn't want to recombine the D-brains in a single cycle for it to wrap around. How much time do I have?
What do you need?
I don't know.
Try to wrap up in the next
2 minutes. Okay. Okay, so to my surprise, I probably will not be able to cover as much stuff as I wanted to do. But okay, maybe I'll just give you a preview of what we are going to do next. And I had a feeling that we probably would be sticking with only one picture for the whole set of lectures. So originally, my plan is to start from intersecting brains, but in great detail, and then introduce magnetized D-brains and D-brains as singularities. Most likely, with my pace, we would be covering intersecting brains in the next lecture, plus a quick p-duality into the 2B frame, and incorporate fluxes and into one simple example. So I probably won't have time to talk about warp throats, in particular something like the Carbonell transfer background, as well as examples. I don't know. Are there still one?
Yeah.
let's see what we are going to cover tomorrow. But okay, so far I have only done everything in the non-compact setting. I have set up the conditions when they preserve a common supersymmetry. There are new features that arise when you try to put everything in a compact setup. So that would be next. And the new features would be that there could be multiplication of families. So instead of getting only one chiral fermions at the intersections, you can get multiple copies. And in particular, the interesting case is if you have three copies of the field that transform in the same representation, you could get three generations of matter. For the standard model. But it also introduced some additional subtlety, namely there are consistency conditions that you need to satisfy. For instance, D-brains carry Ramon Ramon view, so if you put that into a compact setting, you need to cancel the charge. And so we would go over that and relate that to the non-being cancellation. And finally, that's still not enough to construct a model. We need to introduce oriented codes. And so that would be, I guess, next time here. Maybe I should just stop here and see if you have any questions. Anything that was, I was rushing too much or I was being too slow, you should let me know. How many of you think that I've been doing, things way too slowly? How many of you think that I have been rushing like a madman? So, am I being perfect? All right, so I hope minimally we would be seeing an explicit model in the next lecture, namely a model with satisfying all the consistency constraints, at least in a global setup where and not only about local models that I was describing today. Thank you. Yeah. It is a bucket of